Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is consumer expert Grace Gorsden. And as the days and nights turn colder and our energy bills rise even higher, is it better to leave the heating on low all day or high in short bursts? We answer some of your common winter energy usage questions. Plus, is this the future? A home insulating robot called what else but Greta Thunberg could help you go green and save you money. Also today, I'm not a crypto investing genius, and you probably aren't too. Simon warns investors, that was Simon talking, not me. Simon warns investors who've made big returns and applaud their own brilliance about the perils of doing so. Plus, have the team found the best trick for maximizing your Avios points? And who builds a flat without a doorbell? Or rather, what idiot rents a flat without a doorbell? But whose responsibility to install one is it anyway? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, as we enter the colder months and with cheaper fixed deals having disappeared, millions face soaring energy bills. So if you can't switch, but you still obviously need to heat your home, what is the best way to do it without overspending? Grace, let's go through some of this. I know that these sort of energy saving things go down really well with This Is Money audience, and unsurprisingly too. So this is, you've got six here. If I put them to you, can we just rattle through and go for it?
Right, yes, number one, let's go then. For it.
Right, okay, you ready, Grace? How much does it cost to use an electric heater for an evening? How does this compare to 2 years ago? And why did you ask whether it compares to 2 years ago? Is that when energy was sort of a reasonable price, or has the electric heaters changed a lot?
Yeah, no, basically 2 years ago is pre-pandemic, and when energy levels were at their most competitive, there was a lot more suppliers, in the market. So a couple of these we compared to 2019 for comparison. So an electric heater for 5 hours on one night as of last month on a default tariff would cost someone around £2.84 on average. Meanwhile, in November 2019, you'd be looking at £2.62, which is a difference of 7.7%. So you are paying more now, which I think is unsurprising to most people, considering the energy crisis that we're still currently going through.
Right. I'm going to bat between the two of you. Simon, you're not off the hook. So number two, which uses more energy, an electric blanket for an hour or boiling a full kettle for a hot water bottle?
Which do you think?
Electric blanket? Blanket?
No. No, it's the kettle. It's the kettle.
But you can have a cup of tea as well.
Okay, using an electric blanket for 1 hour would cost you about 1.9 pence. Oh. So per night, you'd be spending just under 2p on warming up your bed so you can climb in. It's nice and warm and cozy. This may not be the best move, though, because actually you need your body temperature to drop slightly to give you the best chance of falling asleep. But okay, that's by the by. Lots of people like a nice warm bed. Meanwhile, boiling a 1.7 litre kettle to fill a hot water bottle would cost 3.98p. It costs you nearly 4p when you boil the kettle every time if you fill it up. I don't know how much it costs if you only half fill it. So there you go. I don't know. So if someone wanted to have your electric blanket on all night, though, for example, for 8 hours, if you decided to slowly cook yourself in your bed, that would be 15.2p.
Do you remember Rachel Rickard-Strauss, once of this parish, had something about, what did she make, porridge or something, and then stick it in her bed or some such food stuff? And no, literally, she's Grace's face there. Sorry, I didn't describe that very well. Good job, I'm not a broadcaster. She made it in a pan. And then presumably when the pan had cooled sufficiently, she then put it in her bed. And by the time she got to bed, is that right?
It was something like that. It was like a kind of like, you know, bed warming pan vibe. But I was remembering that while we were starting off this section. I was trying to remember what it was, because there was some kind of like weird, you know, energy tips article that she did. And somehow I translated it in my head into her like cooking something in her bed with the electric blanket. But it wasn't that. One of the other ones was like, after you've cooked stuff in the oven, open the oven door to let the heat out. It wasn't cook stuff in your bed.
You know, she did have it in a pan, but I'm thinking, why would it be porridge? Because if you want to heat your bed before you go to bed at night, by the time in the morning, it'll be concrete. I mean, I've left porridge in pots before. All right, anyway, how much does it cost, Grace, to use a tumble dryer now compared to 2 years ago?
Okay, so as of now, if you are on the standard default tariff. A tumble dryer cycle, just one, costs 96.8p, so just under a pound. This has gone up
for one cycle, a pound.
Just one cycle, yeah.
Oh, that's a lot, isn't it?
I thought so too, yeah. And especially as a lot of people will be using it a lot more during the winter months, obviously, airing out clothes is not as easy. Compared to 2019, it's gone up by 7.4p. So actually it was 89.4p in 2019, gone up 7.4p to now 96.8p. And while that doesn't sound like a huge jump, if you're using a tumble dryer twice a week, I worked out that it will cost households £7.10 more a year than it did 2 years ago. So, I mean, and if you're using it more often, if you've got a bigger family, if you're, yeah, using it more often, then you can double that, say, four times a week to £14. So it is quite a lot.
I've already used it twice today, Grace. It's honestly...
Well, there you go.
I know, you've made me think, no, I'm going to wait. Is it better to wait till it's full or to get it absolutely right for the certain amount of clothes? Like this amount of clothes is 15 minutes or 2 minutes. Anyway.
I don't know, because I always fill my washing machines and I know you're not meant to do that. So I'm probably not the best person to ask.
As long as it gets it clean and dry. Is it better, Simon, to leave the heating on low all day and have it on hotter for just some periods of the day, as opposed to what, right? Really high all day, or because that would be expensive.
Yeah, permanent t-shirt weather. Actually, when I was a student, we did have that kind of scenario, because we had some kind of heating that you couldn't adjust the temperature of or properly turn off, and it was just permanent t-shirt weather.
We used boiling to have the, or freezing.
It was when I was in halls in the first year, and also the bills were included in our rent, so you didn't pay any more, so there was no incentive for us to get it fixed. We literally used to open the windows in the middle of winter to cool the place down, which is like environmentally hideous. Okay, this is a classic one. Yeah. Do you put it on for a little bit? Do you leave it on all day? Depends on a number of factors. Sarah Broomfield, energy expert at Uswitch, said, deciding whether it's cheaper to leave your heating on all day or if you should only switch on when you need to is an age-old debate. And with many people still working from home, it's more relevant than ever. But the answer actually comes down to insulation. The greater the heat loss from your home, the more energy you will need to maintain the inside temperature, which means that for those living in properties that aren't well insulated, the cost of leaving your heating on all the time will be especially expensive. So this is where the whole, like, it's like the underfloor heating vibe, isn't it? Lower temperature, but just like gently on, warms the place up versus blasting it out from the radiators. If your home is very well insulated, you could probably leave it on a low temperature all the time and it will keep the heat inside nicely. If your home is badly insulated, you are literally just heating it for the heat to seep out of the house. So you're wasting that energy. So it's better to just use it when you need it. The best thing to do is to program your heating system so that it comes on at times when you need it. With modern thermostats, you know, they can be quite smart. You can have different temperatures at different times of different days, weekdays and weekends. You can do a different one for every single day of the week. And you can obviously get the smart thermostats, which at least two people have recently told me have gone completely haywire on them.
Yeah. I've just moved into a flat that you need a PhD to work out how everything works, but it is very well insulated because it's newly built. And so everything's sort of modcon and they've got all this sort of heating thing. I don't know how to work it. Look, they've got underfloor heating. Wear slippers.
I've been living in my house for over a year now. We have two heating and hot water controls and I cannot work out how they communicate with each other. I'm sort of only 75% certain of how it's working.
Does stupidity cost us more? Sorry, next one is it cheaper to have central heating on or an electric heater on?
Overall, central heating is much cheaper. In fact, using an electric heater can cost twice as much, according to the Energy Saving Trust, at least. But it will depend on where you live, as do most of these questions, to be honest. The sort of insulation you have will depend on where you live. So electric heaters can be better if you're using them in just one or two rooms, if you're in a small space. However, generally, if you're in a bigger property, central heating will be better for you. Again, if you have an electric heater, it depends on what type, because there's multiple types. So if you've got a halogen one or an electric convector one, and then as I keep saying, it depends on the sort of property. If you've got good insulation, what are your windows like, the efficiency of your actual heater and your central heating. Talking about heaters, I've never lived anywhere with central heating apart from when I was at my parents, so I've always had to rely on electric heaters. So one day I would love to live somewhere where I have the problem where I can't figure out how to work something, because I think that would be much nicer in winter.
Yeah, I think so too. All right, then, finally, Simon, should households leave the heating on low when away, or is it better to turn it off entirely?
Okay, this depends on what time of year it is, yeah. Right? So if it's summer, you'll probably be okay and where you live. But yeah, don't be that person who goes away in the middle of winter and turns their heating off and then their pipes freeze and burst and it costs them lots of money. And actually, in some instances, you might find on your home insurance that there's a clause that says it won't pay out if you do that. So do leave the heating to come on for a bit. And particularly if you're going away in winter and you've looked at the weather forecast and there's going to be a cold snap and you're thinking, woohoo, I'm off to the sunshine. Don't leave your house to freeze, because this is a real classic one and a common one. And maybe even if you can get someone to come in and check.
So this is not about saving money or saving heating. It's just about saving your house from a big burst pipe episode.
You will save yourself a little bit of money by turning your heating on.
Yeah, right. You
could turn it down though, reduce the temperature. I mean, they say a minimum of 12 degrees. I would be thinking maybe a little bit warmer than that. But yeah, could just turn it down so when it does come on, it comes on at a lower heat. And look, here's a bonus one. Okay. Was Rachel cooking
haven't you?
Porridge.
Yeah.
And leaving it in her bed.
Yeah.
B, a roast chicken and leaving the pot in her bed. Or C, rice pudding.
Rice pudding, that's got to be it. Because why else would you leave porridge? Because at least rice pudding doesn't stick to the side. It's got to be rice pudding.
Okay, yeah, I'll read it to you. She wrote...
When was this?
The 3rd of January, 2014. At first, I thought it was a joke. A friend cooked a rice pudding over Christmas. Thick, creamy, so delicious, I asked for the recipe. This is what they gave me. Stir and bring rice to a boil. Place lid on pan. Put in bed for 2 hours. I thought they were taking the mickey. Or perhaps, since they're Scandinavian, it was a literal translation that didn't work in English. Or maybe they were so proud of their winning recipe, they didn't want to share the real details. But then they demonstrated. You put the ingredients together, bring the pudding to the boil, and keep the lid tightly on, wrap it in blankets and duvets, and put it in bed for a couple of hours or so. The result, I can vouch, is a spectacular pudding. There's no risk of scorching the milk or browning the base of the pot when it's snuggled up in a duvet. And it's a nice saving on your energy bill because you haven't left the oven or hob on for hours and it's warmed your bed up. If you get straight into bed after eating rice pudding.
There you go. Rice pudding. I'll be honest with you, I'm never going to try that. But it sounds interesting nonetheless. Home insulation. It's big news at the minute. Words you never thought you'd say. Thanks or not thanks to protests from Insulate Britain and the government's drive to make homes more environmentally friendly. It makes our houses warmer. It increases energy efficiency, meaning we save money on our bills and cut down emissions. But it can also be a bit of a big old mess if you are, especially under the floorboards. But, Grace, are robots the answer? And are they really called Greta?
Yes. And yes, possibly.
Right. Fair enough. Tell us more.
Okay, so there's this company called Qbot based in London who use robots to install insulation under floors. Obviously, it depends where you live. Not everyone's going to be able to benefit from this. But if you are in a home that has suspended flooring, you may be able to get one of these robots to install underfloor insulation. It sounds a bit mad, but actually watching a video of it, it's really quite clever actually. So these robots, basically, if you have an access hatch, can go under your floorboards when you have suspended flooring. They will scan the area. The little robot will go in, scan around, so the person controlling it can see what's under the floorboards, and then essentially they are able to spray the insulation under the floorboards, which then expands, filling any gaps, blocking drafts essentially. You've got insulation under your home, quick and easy, done by a robot. And so far, I believe they've done 2,000 homes, which is quite a lot. Yeah.
And how much is it?
It depends, again, with all of these things as to what sort of home. If you're in a typical 2-3 bed semi-detached, roughly around 3,000 to 3,500 to insulate.
And how much energy can you save?
You can save quite a lot of energy, so it claims.
So it claims.
Again, it depends. I mean, I think it would depend on each house, but basically it says, it did a study of 100 of the homes where it installed underfloor insulation, and it said each household cut its yearly CO2 emissions by 655 kilograms on average, which is equivalent to saving, equivalent to the greenhouse gas emission saving of over 1,700 miles driven in a car. So basically, that's quite a lot, I would think. More importantly, I think for a lot of people, it is also saving them money equivalent to around £150 a year on their energy bills. Again, depending on your home, how big it is, that sort of thing.
All right. Well, it sounds all very interesting. We're going to move on from that, though, because back in May, our Simon bought some Ethereum. This week, the cryptocurrency hit a record high. And at the time of writing, his investment was up 62%. Simon, where is it now? Where is it now?
I haven't checked.
All right, fair enough. Well, you do that now. You spent too long trying to look for rice pudding recipes on the internet. Anyway, you've also got, Simon, a small amount of Bitcoin. That is up 785%. Neither, you say, makes you a crypto investing genius. This is the subject of your latest article. What are you talking about, Simon? Take it from there. Take the story from there. You are no crypto investing genius. And then what?
I'm not a crypto investing genius, and you're probably not too. That is the line. So crypto has been hitting new highs again this week. And there's nothing like that kind of thing, that kind of bumper gain to get an investor sitting there, patting themselves on the back and going, aren't I smart and clever? I bought this stuff and it's gone up. I know more. I know the market. That's a very dangerous thing to be thinking. It's a classic behavioral investment error to make, is to be congratulating yourself on your wonderful foresight and what a great investor you are, especially when you have something as insanely volatile as crypto. So for example, between me writing my column this week on Wednesday night, and it being published on Thursday morning, the price of Bitcoin and Ethereum both fell about 5%. For a small cap share, which are pretty volatile smaller company shares, that would be notable. I mean, for Bitcoin and Ethereum, it's just all in a day's work. So what's going on here, really, with the huge returns that people have made on crypto? And bear in mind that, you know, Bitcoin over the last year has managed to, since the start of the year, it's managed to double to hit a peak of more than 60,000, halve to hit 30,000, and then more than double again. And that's considered to be the best known and one of the more stable of the cryptos. Some of the others have got insane, you know, multi-thousand percentage rises. But basically, what's really happening there is that for people sitting with big returns, yes, they were brave. Yes, they bought. Yes, it's gone up. Yes, there are all those other things. They may have done their research. They may not have done their research. They may have a trading strategy. They may just be completely gung-ho and be chucking the money in. But luck and a colossal speculative boom are the things that are really driving those prices up. And it's worth considering that, because it can help you avoid the mistakes that thinking I'm a genius trader bring about. There was something I read earlier this week by an investment strategist called Joachim Clement of Liberian Capital. And his note was entitled, I picked that stock so it won't go down. Now, this was based on a study that was done at the University of Alicante by two academics there. And they did a lab test with some shares that they invented. And then they did it with some real life shares. And what they did was the participants were shown share price movements initially for a selection of invented stocks. And then they were asked to estimate the future returns. They were then either randomly assigned three stocks or could choose three that they liked the most. Before they were given the stocks, in about 57% of cases, they thought they'd have a positive return in the future, having looked at the data that they were given. When they were given three randomly, their future expectations remained pretty much the same. When they picked three themselves, their expectations for future returns increased. So just the act of picking three stocks that they knew were invented and they had seen some invented evidence of price movements, just picking them themselves made them think they were going to go up more. In the second experiment, six real-life glamour growth companies were introduced: Alibaba, Facebook, Meta, as we should call it now, Uber, Netflix, Tesla, and Zoom. Process was repeated. Again, participants were assigned three at random. They had expectations of future returns that remained similar to you know, before they were given any of these. And those who picked the three they liked best dramatically increased their predicted returns. Mr. Clements said, just because they actively picked those stocks, they thought they had to have a higher return, even though they did not think so before they chose them. And if we've already chosen an investment, right, and it's gone up substantially, that effect is surely only going to be more pronounced. So if you've already picked some Ethereum and you bought it in May and it's gone up by 62%, and bear in mind that the first thing that happened after I bought that Ethereum was that it went down further. So a friend of mine was saying, you should buy some Ethereum, you should buy some Ethereum. And I bought some at what was a price that was substantially lower than where it was in the recent past before that. And it kind of went up a little bit and then went down and then it stayed down. So for actually a reasonable amount of that time, my investment has been underwater. It's the same with the Bitcoin that I bought in like early 2018, just after the crash, is that it went up initially and then it went down. And then for a long period of time, I was either down by quite a lot or only up by a very small amount. It's only actually been relatively recently in the past year or so that it's gone up substantially. You know, this isn't to say that you can't adopt practices, rules, strategies to make you a better investor, do your research, increase your chance of success and so on. But it's always wise to know when to count your lucky stars rather than applaud yourself as a master of the universe. So basically, I just wondered,
is this specifically to crypto? Had you done got a
85%
return on, I don't know, any of your other investments, which aren't quite so controversial? You know, could you go, yeah, I'm all right, I'm pretty good at this, or is nobody any good at it? Are we all
okay?
Just sort of...
Okay, so I think the big risk with crypto is that even for people who invest in other stuff, they're probably going to be looking at their crypto in isolation, so they'll be holding it somewhere different to where they would hold the shares or the funds or the investment trusts that they also hold. And so they're not looking at it within their portfolio of investments, right? Mm. And for people only investing in crypto, obviously that's a major risk. And there's lots of people out there who have only put money into crypto or who are massively overexposed to it. It's hugely volatile. Realistically, it should be a small part of a diversified portfolio if you're going to do it. And you should then accept that even if it's only 5% or 10% of that portfolio, it can massively change the overall returns. But so if I was looking at this within the context of my ISA, for example, where I've got lots of different investments, then I'd be looking at it and go, well, yeah, well, that one's up, you know, 62%. That one's up 700%. Wow. But that one's down, you know, 40%. That one's down 50%. I mean, you should really be cutting that kind of loser. But you're not looking at these things in context. You're only looking at it in isolation in many cases because it's not held in the same place. So you don't have the same thing like I would do with looking at some of my shares and thinking, oh, well, those ones are up. But then down the bottom of that portfolio, I can see all the red. And then furthermore, I think there is this risk of outsized returns totally warping people's views. And this is something the FCA has touched on a couple of times when it's warned about the highly speculative and volatile nature of crypto. But it's also something that's been talked about, you know, in terms of like the meme stock stuff earlier this year, even the massive rebound in certain companies in the stock market after the COVID crash. Mm. People have got used to multiple double digit returns from investments. And so they start to expect that kind of multiple double digit return, a realistic return on like investment overall, if you're doing well in any given year for a properly diversified portfolio, even if it's one that's only invested in the stock market, realistically, is like about 7 or 8% a year. And that's doing well. Many people would tell you that's way too high expectation. So when you're looking at stuff that's up tens or hundreds of percent, it totally warps people's views.
What's the danger of that, Simon? More people likely to head off and find more riskier investments? I don't mean crypto. I mean, you know, some other things that are, dare I say, a bit more dodgy. Or they quit investing altogether because they think, oh, this is rubbish.
Yeah, it is. I mean, well, the risks are that, you know, you take too much risk, that you think everything's going great, you pile too much in, and then all of a sudden you've lost a load of money. And I mean, taking Bitcoin, for example, if you could have bought at the peak in April and then lost 50%. In a relatively short period of time. I mean, the last crash, you know, some of the crashes, there's been like 90% pullbacks. People lump their life savings into this stuff because they think it's going well. They see other people making money. There's that FOMO thing going on, and people are taking outsized risks. And many people will tell you that they know they're taking those risks and they're happy doing it. But it's one thing to say that; it's another thing to basically have lost the vast majority of your savings very quickly. And then the problem is that you might try and make it back. I was speaking to someone about this week, a guy called Glenn Goodman. He's an author of a book called The Crypto Trader, but he's also an investor as well in other stuff, in stocks and things. And he's been trading, he trades full time, basically personally on his own account. And he was saying that, you know, he is listening to people now talking to him about stuff and about crypto and things like that, and repeating the same mistakes that he was hearing back in, you know, 2017. And it's, you know, they're like, no, it can't crash and all that kind of stuff. It's like, it was only like 4 years ago. And in fact, actually you say that, but the thing from after April when it peaked and then dropped 50%, that was only a few months back. You know, people have very short memories, especially when they feel like they're making lots of money. Anyway, Glenn's going to be joining us at a special panel event that we're doing. It's like a live streamed version of our investing show. It's going to be Bitcoin and crypto demystified. Now, we've always tried to keep a kind of healthily open but skeptical mind on crypto at This Is Money. And what we're going to be doing is looking at it for our readers, for our viewers, for our listeners. And we're going to have Glenn and some other experts explaining how blockchain works, why it's considered important, how innovative entrepreneurs are coming up with ideas for decentralized finance, decentralized platforms, and looking at Bitcoin, Ethereum, what's the difference? Why do some people say Ethereum is better than Bitcoin? What are the other main altcoin rivals? And trying to give a really good sort of understanding to people of the basics of this. And it's next Tuesday. It's at 1 p.m. You can also catch up, so you don't actually have to be available at 1 p.m. on Tuesday. So don't make that mistake. But if you come to thisismoney.co.uk/crypto-event, you'll be able to find the details.
Sounds very interesting. And if it's the same Glenn Goodman that I used to work with,
it probably is.
Yeah, really, really nice chap. Very interesting, very smart man. All right, then. I'll ask you to say that again at the end. So don't worry if you haven't written that down, Simon. We'll repeat it at the end if I remember. If I don't remember, Simon, you remind me. So this week, the special relationship returned as Brits were finally welcomed back to the United States. Given all that shopping for gym equipment, garden furniture and hot tubs that we did during the pandemic, you may have found you've built up a fair amount of Avios points to use. The problem is, oftentimes the BA website can be tough to navigate to find availability, and that is where Reward Flight Finder steps in. So Grace, what is Reward Flight? This is really hard to say. What is Reward Flight Finder and why would you need it?
So Reward Flight Finder is a website and app that is consistently tracking British Airways seat availability. And as you said, a lot of people who have built up Avios points find it quite difficult to spend them, as they find it difficult to actually find the flights they can use the points on. So this website and app, it tracks all the seat availability and it alerts members when seats are released that you can use your Avios points on. It will save people a lot of time and a lot of money. So people generally, if they want to find one, they'll have to put in a search destination and a time. And if they can't spend their points then, they have to start the process all over again for a new destination or a new time. Whereas this website and app does it all for you all in one page, so you can see it all in one place. It helps you find where you're looking to go to. There's a map view if you are a silver or gold member, so a paying member, which means you can see all around the globe at one point what seats are available, what cabin class they are, and what dates, making it a lot easier to spend your points and saving you, a lot of time and hopefully a lot of money as well.
I've never got involved with Avios points, I'll be honest with you, Grace, and I do travel quite a lot, so it would probably make sense. But what's the appeal? Are they really good?
Personally, I haven't used them also, but I know people that do and love it. So I think if you're, for example, someone who shops at Sainsbury's and has a Nectar card, or you have an Amex, you can build up these points quite quickly if you spend quite a lot. And to be honest, like if you're looking to go to a long-haul destination, flights aren't that cheap, so you could be saving hundreds if not thousands of pounds depending on how many points you've got. And obviously the appeal is cheaper holidays, and that's what everyone wants. And now that travel is, as you said, it's opening back up again, a lot of people will have a lot of saved up Avios points from the last year or two even that they haven't been able to spend yet. And perhaps next year, this winter even, people will be looking to go away, hopefully somewhere a bit further afield, and be able to spend their points. So this app, and it's a website as well, can help you do that. And it will alert people, which I think is the main thing. So people, depending on what membership they're on, will get regular alerts. They're daily at least, if not more, telling you when seats are released, where they are to, and how many points they cost. So it's very easy to break down how many points you have and what where you can go for that amount of points.
You have some top tips in your article to find the best seats.
Yeah. So as I said earlier, if you're a silver or gold member, so that's a silver $2.99 a month membership or gold $4.99 a month membership, you have this map view, which allows you to see all destinations in one place. Basically, it's a lot easier way to see where you can spend your points. There are other tips that Reward Flight Finder have given, which includes creating alerts as early as possible. Apparently, British Airways release seats nearly a year in advance, so like 355 days for these Avios points that can be spent on. So if you know, for example, next year you want to go somewhere in August or September and you know where, set up an alert now, they suggest, so that when it does come up, it's already there and you can spend them as soon as possible before the seats are taken by someone else. You can also on the app put in several destinations. So if you know, for example, an area but you don't know exactly where you want to go, you can create up multiple alerts so that you can see seats that are released for all those different places. And also it does say, and I think this possibly is the most important, if you get an alert and it's somewhere you want to spend your points, book directly with BA as soon as you can before someone else takes them. From what I understand, they go very quickly.
Sounds a bit of a palaver. I mean, if this is the app that's trying to help you get seats, and it's, oof, goodness me, it's a wonder that anybody gets it. I don't know where I'm going to be next week, let alone Simon.
Yeah, I think one of the two ways that you can build these up is either through credit card spending, like if you've got one of the Avios credit cards, the Amex cards, and you do a lot of your spending on it, make sure you pay it off in full. Basically, not paying your bill just for 1 month and incurring interest will basically cost you probably quite a lot of any benefit that you're getting. But if you're smart and you pick up all the bonuses and you do all that stuff, then you can get lots of points. Lee is a big fan of doing this. Okay, so he's got lots of points. But also if you travel for business, especially if you're traveling to the States, which obviously people haven't been doing much of over the last year and a half or so, but before that, people who travel for business and travel to the States can pick up quite a lot of points, because although your work might be paying for your ticket, you can pick up the Avios for it. So I've got a couple of friends who fly quite a bit for work. One of them flies all around the world. The other one flies reasonably regularly, but not all the time. Maybe once every couple of months or so would be flying to California and back. And so you pick up loads of points, and they use them regularly. They use them for holidays, for the family. They use them for upgrading seats as well, is one thing that people always like to do. But they are always talking about what pain in the backside it is trying to book the flights. And I sent this to them, and you know, one of them came back to me and said, thanks, that's actually really helpful. So there you go.
There you go indeed. Right. We have a reader question now. For the first time, I can actually say, I can read it out and not say, that's not me saying it, but the reader. Because, dear listener, I am the secret reader with a question. I am the idiot that rented out a flat without a doorbell. But in all honesty, have you ever felt the need to check something so fundamental? So anyway, my flat, I've just moved in. It's ground floor. It's an old building that's been converted into four flats, two down, two up. I have a separate sort of yard area with a pin pad security gate and no doorbell. There is no other way for anyone to get my attention than to knock on the bedroom window. Not ideal. Ticky, not ideal. I was going to say not ideal if I'm in it because I can't hear, but not ideal if I am in it because I'm in my bedroom. So I spoke to the letting agents who are managing the property on behalf of the landlord. They were a bit not sure about what to do. I think they said no. In the end, it's the landlord's responsibility. I also spoke to the developer who said, oh, we left it for you to do. You didn't leave it. You forgot. We left it for you to do so you could install your own. And it's funny because she messaged the other day and said, oh, that broken radiator, new one's coming. Can you leave the back door open? Because they can't get in. And I said, yeah, really useful if I had a doorbell. But Grace, I've gone on about this. You actually took the case up. I did it as a bit of a joke. I emailed you as a dear reader thing. And you actually answered it. But I don't like your answer. I'll be honest with you. I don't like it.
But yes.
Explain what the answer is. And then I'll say I don't like it again.
I spoke to quite a few experts in the property industry, all of which unfortunately agree with your letting agent, which is the landlord has absolutely no obligation to provide you with a doorbell, or in fact actually a postbox, which seems a bit mad. And as you say, it's one of those things, who really checks if their new property is going to have a doorbell? It comes as an assumption. But no, apparently, because it's not a security measure, rather a measure of convenience, the landlord doesn't actually have to have one installed. One thing I did find interesting was someone from Justice for Tenants said that it sounds like not having a doorbell could be an indicator the property was not converted properly with the correct planning permissions. And so that was one good piece of advice, which was if you can check with your council or any relevant department within your council that could tell you whether it was converted properly or not. I'm not sure how difficult that would be or how far it might actually get you, but it's an interesting point. Unfortunately, a lot of the people I spoke to as well suggested you may just have to buy your own wireless doorbell.
Yeah, no, that's true. It's not going to happen. I'm not going to buy my own. It's not expensive. I know. They're only about 20 quid or something. But out of principle, I'm already paying far too much. We have a renting crisis at the minute and everyone's bumping up the prices. So I'm already paying far too much. My consideration, I was doing some research into this, is anything that seriously impacts on the quality of your life at the place that you are living is the responsibility of the landlord. This seriously impacts on the quality of my life. And I'm wondering if I had a disability, for example, and I don't know what the answer is. And it is a security risk, because the only way anyone can ever get access to me is by leaving the back gate open. That's a security risk. Otherwise, what's the point in having a pin pad security gate there? And I've already had to go to the post delivery office, not close by, twice in 2 weeks of being here. So I think it seriously impacts either way. I'm digging my heels in on this one. So far, 2 weeks on, I haven't got a doorbell. This must be an oversight in the regulations. I cannot believe that you cannot have a situation where you can have a postbox and a doorbell and that not be an issue. Honestly, Simon, I think we need to take this to the highest powers that be. This is an oversight, surely. I'm sounding like Boris Johnson now.
I would tend to agree with you. That I would consider a doorbell probably a reasonably essential thing in today's day and age of multiple deliveries, etc. I mean, ours only works about 50% of the time, and I must admit the 50% of the time that it isn't working is a slight issue. Can you not buy like a little portable doorbell? An electric one that you just stick up and then it rings.
Do you know what I'm
going to
do? You know those bells you get in pubs for closing time? The reason I say that is because the developers moved in upstairs. So I'm going to install a pub closing time bell. And if anyone wants to get my attention, they can ring the bell, because they will also alert the developers upstairs. Don't like it? Well, they left it up to me to decide. It is also, I think, a question that if anything goes wrong with the doorbell, they don't want to be responsible, so I have to fix it. Either way, digging my heels in on this one. If anyone has any information on this that can help me in my quest to get a doorbell. We have a postbox, by the way. It's quite a good postbox. And in all other regards, the flat is good, apart from the literature you have to read to understand it. But no doorbell. No doorbell.
I must admit, if I was your landlord, I'd just get you a doorbell.
I would get me a doorbell. I can be very annoying. But
well, we know you do that. You've just been complaining about it for 5 minutes.
It's the letting agents that are supposed to be dealing with it. I'm going to do it. Right, anyway. If anyone has any advice for me, let me know. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us @thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. And just a reminder on what I said earlier, Bitcoin and crypto demystified is live streamed next Tuesday at 1 o'clock. You can watch it on Catch Up as well. But sign up now, register now to sign up and get the link. thisismoney.co.uk/crypto-event.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.